RCR with Paul Brennan.
Catherine Austin Fitz, once a Wall Street executive and housing and urban development official. She's a financial guru and founder of the Solari Report. And if you remember back to June last year, 2024, she was a guest with my colleague Alistair Harding as part of his series on central bank digital currencies. And if you remember, a few weeks ago, we chatted with Naomi Wolf, and Catherine's name came up there. We'll get to that shortly. But it's my great pleasure to welcome Catherine Austin Fitz to RCR again. Catherine, thanks for coming on again.
Thank you. I have such fond memories of New Zealand. Haven't been back since the pandemic, though.
Oh, you haven't missed anything.
Yeah.
Can tell you that. What particular areas, just curious, of our country did you visit?
So because I was working with Scoop Media, I spent more time in Wellington than any place. But we used to do drive around, so we'd go road tripping across the island. But I've spent a lot more time in the North Island than the South Island. Of course, the South Island being very beautiful, I've always wanted to go.
Yeah, our greatest hits are down here. That doesn't include me necessarily, because it's where I am. I'm talking about the scenery, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. I want to play just a couple of quick clips because I think it's highly relevant. First one is Christine Lagarde, president of the European Central Bank, just this week.
Meaning European Parliament, meaning European Council, meaning European Commission, so that we can eventually, you know, not put to bed, but put to reality this digital euro. The deadline for us is going to be October of 25, and we are getting ready for that deadline, but we will not be able to move unless the other parties, the stakeholders as I call them, Commission, Council and Parliament, actually complete the legislative process without which we will not be able to move. And I think it is critically important, and it seems to the agnostic or the skeptics, it seems to be more relevant and more of an imperative now than ever before, both on the wholesale and on the retail level, both.
So that's Christine Lagarde within the past week. October 2025, they want to have the digital euro in place. So it's all engines full throttle by the sounds of things. What's your reaction to that?
So the BIS, the Bank of International Settlements, has been leading a process for several years now globally to introduce central bank digital currencies. And that sounds simple, but if you look at all the central banks, they've been working on different plans as to whether they should do one that's wholesale just for the banks to operate in the banking system, or they want to do retail, one that is for the general public. But at the same time, there is an effort to also consider doing it privately. So instead of having the central banks do it, have the members of the central banks, the banking system, do something that's much more privately owned and controlled. But what they're both trying to do is they're both trying to do programmable money in a system that is all digital monetary system. Because when you move from right now we all use digital money, right? So you, whether it's the dollar or the Kiwi dollar, you're using digital money most of the time. So, but the difference between this digital money and a CBDC or a private equivalent, which is probably going to be called a stable coin, is you're talking about something that can be combined with a digital ID and a social credit system to end currency as we know it and become a complete control system. So it's both a surveillance system and a control system, because we're talking about the ability to stop you from affecting transactions or affecting transactions you don't want to make. And at the root, it's a change in our political system, because you're talking about taxation without representation. They just take the taxes out of your bank account.
Okay, and here's the other clip. I don't want to get bogged down in too many clips, but I just think it's interesting to hear how this is coming together. And this is Rob Roos, who's a former Dutch politician, and I think up until last year was an MEP. And this is what he had to say really just not too long ago. I'll play this, and then we'll talk some more.
And I have bad news. The Member States and the European Parliament came to an agreement. That means that probably not far from now, the digital identity will be effect in the European Union. Right after this agreement, Commissioner Breton said, now we have the digital identity wallet, we have to put something in it. And what he meant was the digital euro, also known as the central bank digital currency.
Okay. So currency's on the way. The wallet is maybe here. And well, he said the quiet bit out loud there, didn't he?
So there are a couple different pieces to this system. And I think it's confusing for most people because, you know, people use different words to describe, for example, the digital ID. In the United States, it's the real ID. In Europe, you know, they've tried to do it with vaccine passports. But, you know, so you see these different names, but the whole idea is to get a very high quality, government controlled and filtered digital ID, which is interoperable across the globe. So, you know, so it can, the global system can operate with the Euro digital ID, whatever that is, just like they can with the India ID, because you need a very high quality system to say, you know, you're Paul and I'm Catherine, and you can tell the difference between people. So that's one part, is the digital ID. The second part is you need an all digital monetary system. So you've got to get rid of cash. And the debate about whether we're going to get rid of cash now is getting, it's going into a new and very interesting phase, and we should talk about it. But then you want to have, you want to get your banks all on systems like fast payment systems that can handle the kind of traffic we're talking about and the complete control. And then you want to add it with a programmable feature so that money can be programmed. And you can do it with bank accounts. You can do it with Visa and MasterCard. You can do it with a stablecoin. You can do it with a CBDC. All these different systems, as long as you have 100% digital with a good digital ID, you can affect this kind of control. And we often hear about it in the context of China doing it. But literally, we're talking about being able to make many, many rules about how and where and when you can spend your money and being able to centrally control that. And literally, what we've seen is the head of the Bank of International Settlements say it's not our money, it's their money, right? And they can determine how and where it gets spent. And many people will say to me, you know, well, I'm not doing anything wrong. I don't care about that. Well, you know, yes, if they say either you change the healthcare treatments for your child or they'll cut off your money. You know, we're talking about using this kind of control and surveillance to move into the most, you know, intimate aspects of your life, including in ways that right now you would consider criminal. So this is a very frightening, and I don't call it a financial system. If you look at where they're going with programmable money, I call it a slavery system.
And you have to have a wallet to access it as well. So you're in the ID system, whether you like it or not. Is that what that means?
Well, so the question is, can they force you to have the equivalent of a smartphone or a digital, you know, a digital equipment that you have to carry with you to access the system? And of course, one of the reasons many of us are fighting very, very hard for cash is to make sure you can't get that. What's interesting is the leaders in reducing cash in the system have been in Scandinavia. And interestingly enough, I think it's about 6 weeks ago, the Norwegian Central Bank came out and said, you know, it's a very bad idea to just have no cash, because if we see what's happening with these disasters around the world, people need to have cash. And the Swedes just came out and said, you know, we need to have cash for the same reasons. The electricity doesn't always work. And in these disasters, you need to have cash. And one of the great statements was the head of the Bank of New Zealand, who came out, remember the cyclones? He came out and had a press conference and said, thank heavens we had cash, because otherwise we would have just been in real trouble, of course, the electricity being down. And I remember saying on my Money and Market show to John Titus, who's my co-host, I guess the governor of the Bank of New Zealand didn't get the memo.
Well, he's gone now. He went a week and a half ago. He resigned.
Really?
Suddenly. So who knows why? Probably spend more time with his family. That's what they're using.
I have to tell you, we have a very, if you come into Solari, we have a section called Video Shorties. And there's one on financial transaction freedom. And one of the great shorts is we have a president of one of the 12 Federal Reserve Banks in the United States saying CBDCs are terrible. We should never let it happen. And it will mean taxation without representation and destroy American democracy. So I don't think all the central bankers are on board. You know, remember, they and their families are going to be in the slavery system, too. So I think a lot of them, once they come to understand what this is really about, are, and it's interesting because the Fed has been slow walking CBDCs in the United States. And the latest reports from the trackers are that now 15 nations have sort of slowed down on CBDCs. One reason, and you can see this in the United States, is they want to do it privately. So we see the president come out with an executive order saying no CBDCs, but racing ahead on the digital IDs, racing ahead on collapsing civil service and congressional control of fiscal policy, racing ahead on, you know, moving to digital and racing ahead on stable coins in a way that could be the equivalent of private CBDCs.
So possibly the same thing, just with a different sort of veneer coating.
Well, think of it this way. During the pandemic, there was an extraordinary effort by the U.S. government to shut down free speech. But the way they did it was they had the social media companies do it. So the government would tell the social media companies what they should do. And then the social media companies would shut off or censor. But it didn't look like the government. And it wasn't only till later the whole system came out. But it was a very effective way of shutting down free speech in a way that wouldn't have been as blatant and clearly illegal under the Constitution as if the government had tried to do it directly. So I think with a social credit system, you can have much more powerful control. Remember, right now, the Federal Reserve under U.S. law is under the jurisdiction of Congress and has tremendous disclosure responsibilities to Congress if Congress demands to exercise them. Whereas if you do the equivalent of a private synthetic CBDC, the people running it have absolutely no obligation, you know, to the citizens whatsoever.
Is it inevitable?
No. Okay. I do think it is inevitable that an enormous number of people and organizations, you know, what you see all around the world is people racing to be part of the gold rush. And so there's enormous money to be made. There's enormous power to be had. And this is all part of building the digital control grid. And if you look at the money that's been poured into it, if you look at the people going to work doing this, you know, everybody's on board for this because they think, one, it's inevitable, and two, they're going to make a lot of money, and this is the way things are going to go. And there are other ways it's sold. It's sold as fashionable or innovative or cool or, you know, all these other kinds of
convenient
things. If you look at the problems with it, there are very significant problems. For example, headline last week in Texas, if they bring up all the data centers they want to bring up, they will require 30 brand new nuclear plants. The energy demands of this infrastructure is just, you know, beyond belief. Now, maybe they're going to let Breakthrough Energy out of the closet. I don't know.
Zero point. Yeah.
Right. And of course, one of the most intelligent reasons for anybody wanting this kind of complete control is they don't want to bring out Breakthrough Energy without, you know, being able to prevent the weaponization of it. And that requires really unbelievable control. So maybe there's a relationship there. But put that aside, the environmental damage, if everything's got to be digital and everybody's got to interact with digital equipment, worldwide, globally, 8 billion people, and you can't use markets and prices, instead you're going to have technocracy, the environmental damage that will come from, you know, digging up and creating that much sort of metal stuff, it's frightening. So the other thing is, I've always had a belief that this, the plan for complete control is so out of alignment with how the universe works at the most fundamental level of whether it's material science or spiritual knowledge, that it's ultimately so out of control with life. It's so demonic and sort of out of alignment with life. Hmm. You know, I think we're going to have a huge mess. And my concern is not that it succeeds. My concern is before it fails, it's going to kill a lot of people.
Some would say that is actually the end game state of it, that it is almost on a spiritual level, demonic.
Well, you know, it is. It is demonic. And it's funny because I grew up in this really lovely little neighborhood in West Philadelphia. And it was a relatively poor neighborhood. But in those days, you know, one, we didn't know we were poor because we didn't have TVs, so we didn't mind it. You know, we thought we were happy. But the other was, it was about 50-50 African-American. And we used to get these, we called them the old black church mothers, who would be like 80 and 90, and they would be very wise. But, you know, you had a hard time talking to them because they're very strong. And they'd walk around, they'd get angry at something, and they'd say, "It's demonic, it's demonic." And I remember going to the video store the last time, you know, they still had video stores, and yeah. I was walking around looking at the movies, and I was saying, "It's demonic, it's demonic." I said, "Oh, no, yeah. I'm an old black church mother."
Full circle, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So I think, you know, to me, one of the greatest risks as a society we face is our relationship with interdimensional intelligence. And I believe, I don't know if you have ever studied plasma, but I believe the universe is alive.
I've considered that too. And I'm glad you're going there because I'm going to ask you now about that.
Yeah. When you get into money, money is very much, I used to study morphogenic fields a lot. Because when you deal with huge amounts of money and re-engineering huge amounts of money, you're basically re-engineering fields. Hmm. And it's the behavior of markets are very much vested in how people, you know, what they believe, how they feel. And moving markets is basically all about moving fields. And if you see opportunities to move markets, you're very involved in morphogenic fields and sort of how that all works. And especially when you're dealing with very big money. And so, you know, and that's one of the reasons I believe that what they're trying to do is so contradictory to life. But it comes down to each one of us. Are we attracting the divine or are we attracting the demonic? Which, you know, we all have a vote here in the field. And the problem with what's happening is you have way too many people who are going to work to build the control grid, who are investing their money in the stock market to build the control grid, who are putting money in crypto in a way that builds the control grid, are promoting the control grid and want the control grid to grow and are helping, you know, they're literally helping this. And they don't see that. You know, if you look at all the different technologies that make up the control grid, whether it's QR codes or smart meters or electric cars or, you know, all the different pieces, once you fuse all those pieces together with programmable money, click, it synthesizes into one system and you're in the digital concentration camp. But we're building it and we have the power to stop. We don't have to build it.
You mentioned energy before. There's been a lot of debate on energy technology that we may or may not know about. And, you know, I mean, there's the MH370 and all of that. But do you feel that there is something profound that is kind of being hidden?
Oh, absolutely.
Like absolutely. Beyond really what we can, well, up till now anyway, conceive, perhaps.
Well, let me bring it back in a much more practical way. A decision was made after World War II to simply create the equivalent of a breakaway civilization in the United States, to set up legal and financial mechanisms that would allow money to be regularly siphoned off from the regular economy into secret programs, secret budgets, secret facilities. And that world has grown and grown and grown to the point where, from a financial standpoint, it's bigger than, you know, what you and I would think of as our world. So some of us call the breakaway civilization, but I've spent many, many years trying to document, you know, what are the physical facilities, what are the financial mechanisms, how much money, where's the money? I mean, between fiscal 1998 and fiscal 2015, $21 trillion disappeared from the federal government. And then they took the books dark, right? And the books have been dark ever since. So when we calculated the $21 trillion, there was $21 trillion of debt outstanding. The debt's now $36 trillion. So for all I know, they've taken $36 trillion. But if you look at how much money has been siphoned off, and if you look at every indication we have of the technology that they have, you know, we are dealing, you know, it's a little bit like the stories. I never heard any of these stories in New Zealand, but we always had in the United States, where a man develops a family. You know, he travels a lot for business and he ends up with a second family in a different town, and he's got two families. He's trying to finance them from one paycheck, and the two families don't know the other family exists. And, you know, meantime, he's going crazy trying to deal with the situation and finance the whole thing. Well, you know, our world is a little bit like that. And you know, somebody said to me during the pandemic, what do you think is happening? And I said, well, you know, the breakaways pulled out and financed a separate civilization, and now they're breaking back in. So we have built a separate civilization and you know, this breakaway civilization. And if you look at how heavily documented it is, there's no denying that it's real. This is heavily documented fact.
That has the potential to explode so many hits.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, just thinking of the average person in the street who's just getting by and having their little life, trying to conceive of a breakaway civilization, essentially a leech, because they're using, what, the everyday
they're
civilization's
money
to do what they do, right. You know.
I find most people know that, you know, our official story is a lie. So right. At the Solari Report, we say there's an official reality and then there's reality. And the official reality is for the cocktail party and reality is for the investment of your time and money. And you need to know both. And what I find is many people, you know, you're a mother, you're a single parent, you're struggling to, you know, get three kids to school and earn enough money to support them. You don't have time to, you know, think about all of this. At the same time, you know that you're dealing with massive amounts of lie. You just don't want to, you know, you don't want to rock the boat. You don't want to lose your job by talking outside of the official narrative. But for example, if you look at polls of how many people believe that aliens exist or aliens exist and live among us, or there's intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, it's a phenomenal number of people.
What I've found interesting, there's been so many clips and video and everything taken of these things, it seems, just in the last 2 or 3 months, to the point where even someone like me, who's always been curious about that thing, just thinks, oh, that's just another clip of a, you know, that would have blown people's minds a few years ago to have any evidence of anything, even if it's shaky.
But here's the thing, you know, in that world, so I described this whole story on a panel in 2015 at a really wonderful conference called Secret Space Program. And if you go to Solari, you can find it if you just put Secret Space Program in the search bar. But I first started to look into this phenomena in 1998 because the U.S. Navy tried to persuade me that aliens exist and live among us, and invited me to have lunch with aliens. And at the time, I thought they were trying to set me up to look, you know, I thought, okay, this is how I'm going to get framed.
Yeah.
So I
Yeah.
declined to have lunch with aliens, but I said, okay, you know, what are the best books on the topic? Let me read the books. And I read it that I'm a speed reader. I read about 25 books on the whole alien phenomena. And then I couldn't, I decided I couldn't make hide nor hair of it. But one of the things I grappled with over the years was, you know, the fact that there is a phenomena with very advanced technology, and we are financing it. And if you look at the black budget and all the money disappearing from the federal government, that is where a great deal of it is going, clearly. Mm. So, for example, I sat down 3 years ago with one of the best researchers I work with, and we did a project to figure out how many underground bases there were just in America or, you know, in the oceans around America. And we calculated 170 underground bases likely just in America with underground transportation systems. I mean, this is a whole, I'm telling you, this is a whole nother civilization. So anyway, but I think clearly many, many people understand that we are dealing with technology that is very advanced and invisible. So in 1996, we had the Secretary of Defense talk about the fact that we were dealing with weaponry that could mimic natural events like hurricanes or tsunamis or earthquakes. And in fact, you know, I believe they are using weaponry to induce these kinds of events, you know, fires, etc. And so we are watching a very new kind of warfare.
So you're talking Maui and
right.
California and
Northern
blue,
California.
Blue somehow being fire resistant, which is a curious thing.
So in North California, when the fires happened in 2017, I had hundreds of subscribers there who were sending me very, very detailed individual reports of what was happening and what they'd seen, or people they knew and trusted had seen. So I got literally hundreds and hundreds of detailed descriptions, and it was clear that this was not natural.
Right.
It was, you know, it was a clearing. People were being gentrified, you know, they were being pushed out of their homes and communities.
Where does this whole Doge thing, I know we're jumping, but I think they're related, this effort to analyze U.S. government spending and expose the rorts, is this an honest attempt to sort of pull the, you know, the scab off or the Band-Aid off so we can kind of see what's going on? Or because, you know, talking with Naomi Wolf, I mean, when you start to think about the data that is available in an exercise like that, and the people who are conducting the operation, it's hard to know now whether that's an honest, you know, non-demonic thing to do or something else.
So there are two things going on. So the first thing is, very shortly after he was confirmed the Secretary of State, Rubio said, you know, we're in a multipolar world now. And so since World War II, the United States has basically been leading a global dollar system. And certainly since the wall came down, they've been pushing to make that dollar system the leader in a unipolar world. And that model has failed. And now they have to adjust to a multipolar world where they can't necessarily dictate to China and Russia and the BRIC nations as easily as they have before. And so the U.S. has an enormous challenge, which is you have been running a global model. You've been using a very expensive military to run that global model. And now the revenues that you're getting from the model don't cover your military expenses and the subsidy you've been paying the population to get them to go along with you. Right. So you've been buying people into your democracy. So now the question is, how are you going to re-engineer the model? You've got to get revenues up and expenses down. And what you see the new administration trying to do is, how are we going to adjust the model? How are we going to get more resilience at home? How are we going to do more for ourselves, you know, in North America instead of outsourcing everything? Because you've got a trade deficit of $1 trillion plus, and it's really biting. So, and that's part of the focus of getting current expenditures down. Now, if you look at where current expenditures are exploding, believe it or not, they're exploding in healthcare. So the healthcare budget is now more than double military expenses, because essentially, whether you talk about food or big pharma or you know, global spraying or all the things they've been doing, Americans are poisoned, and the disability numbers are off the charts. Dr. Mark Skidmore just finished a study and concluded that if we could return to 2010 levels of disability, we could drop the healthcare expenses $500 billion. And that's why you see so much debate around, you know, the HHS and Secretary Kennedy's.
Is that why Trump sort of kind of moved in close to RFK? Because not so much, I'm sure he would like people to be healthy, but this then lowers the cost of healthcare by doing something logical. And it's more about the money than actually people being healthy.
I think it's a combination of things. I think his reason to get close to RFK was votes and politics.
Yep. Right.
So it was pure power politics. I think he knows that the current level of chronic illness is basically an extinction level event for the current population. Now, I think they can replace most of those people with immigration, but you know, it's still, if you don't try and do your best to do something about it, I think the message is a very dark one. And the message is coming through because they just pulled the nomination of Weldon for CDC. And the message is clearly, you know, we're happy to keep poisoning you and we're going to keep it secret. What's really going on is the message I got. Anyway, so back to DOGE. So I think there is a serious effort to cut expenses. And cut expenses. So if you look at the big expenses they're cutting, so those are the expenses that you would cut if you were going from a unipolar to a multipolar world. So USAID was part of trying to buy everybody. You go into a country and you try to buy them, right? You put them on the payroll, whether it's the NGO or the person or the think tank or whatever. And if you're going to give up and go to a multipolar world, you can't afford to buy that many people in the U.S. or otherwise. Okay. So that's issue number one. Issue number two, if you want to have programmable money and complete control, you have to kill congressional control of the executive branch. And so you've got to destroy the civil service. So I think part of this is the more you can get corporate contractors in place, the more the bankers can control the government. Because remember, the bankers have controlled monetary policy. Now they want to control fiscal policy. And part of doing this is getting to the point where they control fiscal policy. The third thing is, and this is a guess, I couldn't prove this in a court of law, I think the DOGE operation is simply taking all the data. And remember, government payment data is extraordinarily high quality data. And they're just feeding it into Musk's private AI. I think what you're watching, just like you've watched $21 trillion be taken from the U.S. government, I think you're talking about, you know, it was funny because Naomi in one of her presentations said it's $1 trillion worth of data. And she's right. It's a value on that magnitude.
She described it as the most pristine set of data on the planet.
Yes, absolutely. And so I think what they're doing is they're taking the data, and it's a taking. And so this is privatization by the just do it method, because I kept telling Naomi, when I was a political appointee, when I was running FHA, you know, we gave major donors presidential cufflinks. We didn't give them the government, right? Now, what's interesting is if you look at the conflicts of interest between Musk and his activities, you know, there are very strict laws about what a government special employee can do. And if you look at all the inspector generals who've been fired, who were doing investigations of him or his company, you know, if you were coming up into our quarterly wrap up and I'm going through all the different, you know, investigations, he's According to public reports, Musk is out in the market raising capital for XAI and X and SpaceX. And if you look at all the different things Doge is doing that would increase the market value of those three companies, it's just astonishing. I mean, it's just astonishing. Now, of course, Tesla is getting is experiencing bad sales and bad PR as a result of Musk's activity. SpaceX, X, and XAI are all private. So he's in the private markets raising capital on them, but they don't have to deal with this kind of retail stuff.
So that could be seen as very nefarious, strip mining that data for your AI project. I mean, there are other AIs.
Right, but I think this is, I think what you're watching is you're watching the privatization of the entire government because they've only just begun. First, you take the data. You've installed Starlink in the White House campus without the proper security clearances or controls. So right. You now have
that's him
private,
as well.
Yeah, you have access. And that data, the ongoing current event data, as you know, is invaluable. So you have surveillance, you have access, and you have the data all sucking into and controlled, presumably, and again, this is my conjecture, by a private company. And if you look at what they're talking about doing with both crypto and potentially monetizing government assets. So Howard Lutnick, the Secretary of Commerce, has said the U.S. balance sheet has $500 trillion worth of land and mineral resources. And we've seen several trial balloons about how they want to monetize that. Hmm. In fact, they just started last week by announcing a partnership between the Department of Interior and HUD about how they're going to make the federal lands available for affordable housing. And Doge just brought in three private equity people to help re-engineer Social Security. So my prediction is you've got a highly entrepreneurial group of people who are going to go through the entire federal balance sheet and re-engineer, take, steal, privatize as much as they possibly can. And the question is, are they completely dismantling the federal government? What it looks like to me is not completely, because they want to keep, you know, they want to keep the people who institute population control in place.
Population control. What do you mean by that?
So the Medicare budget, the Medicare and Medicaid budget, which needs cutting badly, but, you know, that's one way to control people by, you know, controlling their health care. The big one is, of course, is the Department of Justice and the FBI. So, you know, and HHS, which and Homeland Security, which controls the border. So, you know, immigrants, do we let immigrants in or out? Medicare, do we take care of people's health? Enforcement. So I litigated with the Department of Justice for 11 years, and I kept litigating. I refused to settle because I made them come to court, admit they had nothing, and the whole thing was a bluff the whole time. But, you know, the Department of Justice can be very effective at controlling people and getting them to do what the government wants.
While all this is happening, it's interesting because for the first time, it seems, if we consider the Ukraine war a proxy war, and it's really Russia or USA versus Russia in the end, it appears that Russia has kind of outsmarted their proxy war opponent and has them with, well, Trump said no cards to play for Zelensky, but it seems that Trump has no cards to play.
Yeah, either, so here's ultimately the problem. You had a neocon strategy in the Ukraine, and the neocon strategy has failed. The U.S. was in control of the situation, and so it's the U.S. that's failed, not the Ukraine.
Yeah.
And now the question was, you know, I believe they wanted to clear the Ukraine out, so part of this failure was planned. But the reality is, you know, the strategy was we implode Russia again. You know, we did it in 89, 90, 91. We do it again, and access to those resources will enable us to remain the hegemon vis-a-vis China. That was the theory. it meant that they had to win not at conventional war, but at hybrid war. And one of the great questions, and we talk a lot about this on the Saleri Report, how did the Russians manage to beat the hybrid war strategy? Because they and the Chinese are the only two who have been able to do it globally. Most countries have gotten defeated by the hybrid strategy, you know, which is part media propaganda, but I suspect part is electronic warfare. You know, but what you do is you empower a group of people within the country who will support the empire, not sovereignty. And they were able to maintain a leadership that would essentially protect the country and sovereignty. And one of the things they did, the Russians were very clear, we can't win the media game, but we can win at conventional warfare. So we're going to ignore the conventional warfare. We're just going to keep our mouth shut, and we're going to just keep winning at conventional warfare. And frankly, you know, they have done, if you look at their conventional warfare strategy, what they've done and how they've done it, they've done an excellent job. And one of the reasons they've been able to do an excellent job was they prepared for more than a decade to withstand the financial sanctions, number one. But number two, they've been building, working very hard to build a cost-effective military, including at electronics, for, you know, ever since they sort of got back up out of having been raped in 1991. And it is shocking to see the West's failure, you know, when if you look at what it was going to take to win, the refusal of the West to face what needed to be done and do it, or simply even not try to do this. So this is a huge failure. And it's why Rubio has to say we're moving to a multipolar world. We're moving to a multipolar world because the unipolar effort failed big time.
Which means Russia, and you've included China, they've kind of won, have they? Up to this point, anyway. Pushing that over is incredible, isn't it?
So in one sense, they won. So at the same time, you've got to come into a new way of balancing. In other words, if the United States isn't going to police the world, how are you going to, you know, how are you going to police the world? Or are you going to have a free-for-all where everybody takes whatever they want, you know, if they can? You know, so are we going to go to bully world, or are we going to do something else? Now, the bigger problem is if you look at who financed the president's victory, you know, that group of donors wants war with Iran. And it very much looks like the president is pushing for that. And, you know, if you think part of their problem is the Russians have cut a deal with Iran to, you know, so they have a sort of mutual protection. And, you know, the president is bobbing and weaving and dancing, trying to figure out how he's going to go to war with Iran. And it's not clear to me, you know, he and Putin were on the phone this week for 2.5 hours. It's not clear to me how this discussion is going to happen, other than I just think the Russians are going to keep taking territory in the Ukraine. And the question is, how far do they want to take? I don't know. But there's nobody there to stop them from taking what they want.
Well, the Europeans are sort of rattling sabers, but they're basically neutered, aren't they? They've expended we've heard anyway, their military supplies. They can't really supply anything to Ukraine of any note anymore. And they seem to be like chickens with their heads cut off, running around all over the place.
So let me say two things. The first thing is the danger of running a society with two maps, one being the official reality and the other being reality, is you can't afford to get forget reality when you put together your military plans. So, for example, there's a think tank in Australia that the government started in 2001 that tracks the 64 most important technologies to sort of power and economic performance. And at the end of, I think it was 2008, they calculated that the U.S. led in 60 of the 64. They just came out with their 2024 report and said the U.S. led in seven, China led in 57. Okay, now that happens when an elite forgets about what's real. They're so busy creating stock market pumps and dumps and crypto pumps and dumps and playing financial securitization. They're so busy creating billionaires that they forget about the strategic issues that give you real economic and political power. Okay. So if you look at the US elites and you look at the European elites, they have blown the greatest lead that a civilization has ever had. They've blown it in science and technology. They've blown it in health, although you could say they're just trying to depopulate, and that may be it. But I think they've started to believe their own Kool-Aid. And it's if you look at how bad the failure is, I'll never forget being up in Scandinavia a couple years ago, and I was stunned that anybody thought they were going to win in Ukraine. It was clear the Russians had prepared and were prepared to win at conventional warfare. And I said to a very, very successful, powerful investor, what's the plan? I don't understand why Europe is going along with this. And he said, Germany thinks they're going to get the Ukraine. I said, it's not going to happen. He said, they really believe they're going to get the Ukraine. I said, it doesn't make sense. Now, so one issue is, I think the danger of having a multiple personality disorder is sometimes you believe the wrong personality and you drink your own Kool-Aid. So that's number one. But number two, I will tell you, I pulled out of the elites in 1998. So I pulled out in 1998, and if you know my whole story, and ended up litigating with the Department of Justice. And I said at the time, I'm out because this plan will fail. And I wouldn't have said it this way, the way I would say it now, but the reason I said it would fail is we did not have a powerful enough culture, and we weren't investing enough in our culture to succeed at a unipolar model. You can't run the planet by bullying and force, and you can't run the planet by just, you know, covert operations that runs around and shoot leaders, including your own president. So we didn't have the cultural game to win at unipolar, and we don't have the cultural game to win at unipolar or multipolar right now. And nobody, you know, if you look at who's running the show, whether it's in the Commonwealth countries, whether it's in Europe, whether it's in North America, I see very few leaders talking about where's a culture that can play to win in this environment.
Coming up against time, what's your assessment then? I don't know how far ahead into the future you want to look, but many of us are concerned that we're at sort of like a fork in the road here, almost for our, you know, our civilization, and that everything is up for grabs right now. What's your kind of Catherine Austin Fitz assessment for how positive the future is? Because I think that's weighing on people's minds so heavily right now.
So you're right. Everything is up in the air. It's like taking a deck of cards and throwing it all up. And given technology, that sense of all the cards getting shuffled and thrown up in the air is gonna get worse, not better. Or it's gonna get bigger thanks to AI. But what I would say is that I used to have an ally who would say, the bigger the breakdown, the bigger the breakthrough.
Right.
When everything reshuffles, the question is, whose side are you on? Are you attracting in the divine intelligence, or are you attracting in the demonic intelligence? Which is it? And this is why our personal integrity, our consciousness, and how we use our time and our thoughts and our intention is so important, because when the deck is reshuffled, you know, which way are we going to take it? In other words, we are all together in the invention room, and everybody gets a vote in the field. So what you have to think about, there's a wonderful author who just wrote a book called Unstressable. He used to be the chief business officer at Google. And as soon as he figured out AI, he quit and completely radically changed his life. And he said, if my thoughts can be joyful or productive, and if I'm thinking something that's not joyful or productive, then I've got to get it back in one of those two boxes. And it's one of the things I use to try and make sure I'm doing my best to attract in the divine intelligence.
Nicely put. Yeah.
I think we're in the invention room what kind of future are you going to invent? And get ready for daily creativity and the invention, because the change is dazzling now and it's going to continue to be dazzling.
Catherine Austin Fitz, what a interesting chat. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And someday I hope to be back in New Zealand. I miss it.